I'm here today with Rod Bruyere, and we're meeting in Highland Park, beautiful downtown, quaint village of Highland Park. It's actually northeast Los Angeles here. And I've known Rod, gosh, I've known you for how many years, Rod? 20-some years already?
Yeah, it seems like around 30 years,
actually. It seems like a long time. And Rod Bruyere is of the Ojibwa Nation. He grew up in Canada. And we often talk about old ways, and we talk about some of the traditions that Rod knew growing up. And why don't we begin, Rod, with you explaining to the listener what an Ojibwa Indian is and where the Ojibwa are from.
Well, Ojibwa tribe has several different names, mainly because they were misnomered by Anglo people. But Ojibwe is a...
Misnomered meaning they just gave them some name, right?
Yeah. Or misinterpreted a name that possibly one of the tribes told them they were, or it was misinterpreted in some form or fashion. But we're all known as Anishinaabe, which means the people.
Anishinaabe.
Yeah. And
are you not known as Ojibwe among yours? Is that not your name, your term for your people?
Well, that's the term for our people, but we call each other Anishinaabe.
I see. Yeah. Okay.
We're mostly around the Great Lakes, around Hudson's Bay, James Bay. We're known as Chippewa, too, so if you look on the maps and all that and you see Chippewa, well, that's us, that's Ojibwe's.
And so, in fact, you were saying there's several groups that are really part of the Ojibwa.
Yes, there are, yeah. There's Potawatomi, Menominee. In Canada, they're called Sotos. It's a French word.
What is it?
Soto. It's spelled S-A-U-L-T-E-A-U-X.
Huh.
It's just like the Sioux tribe. The Sioux tribe, it's a French word, and I don't know what it means, but they're Lakota and Nakota and Dakota. Oglala Sioux, they call them. But they're misnomered by misinterpretation. We're related to Dakota tribe in our history. Well, one thing that we believe, like tribal people, is that we're all related. We believe that every one of us...
We just had a bus going by. Okay.
Okay.
So everybody's related, all people.
Yeah, we believe all people are related. You know, we have a prayer that just says, all my relations, you know,
mm-hmm.
And meaning that everything is relative to us, everything that's on the earth is put here for us and relative to us. For every disease, there's a plant or herb to heal it.
Mm-hmm.
So for everything around us is the great circle of life, and we all belong in that. I mean, whether we're Indian or non-Indian, you know, or native or non-native, we're all related.
So where you grew up was Canada, north of Minnesota.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And you were saying that the Lakota, Dakota people further to the southwest, they're related to the Ojibwa too.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. They're North Dakota and South Dakota, and some in Minnesota area.
I see.
You know.
And how was it growing up? You said that it was people were poor generally on the reservation. Is that the way it was?
Yeah. Growing up. Our treaty was signed in 1873, and mainly the treaty was signed because we outnumbered those people that were attempting to live there at the time, and our people were, you know, very in agreement with coming to some kind of an agreement with them.
And this is the U.S. government you're talking about, those people, right?
The U.S. government, and also the Queen of England, who was in power in Canada at the time. It doesn't matter that I was born in Canada, I'm still a native North American,
mm-hmm.
and I'm referred to that wherever I go as a Native American born in Canada. So the treaties were signed anyway, and they were supposed to give us provisions because of the treaty, and they didn't honor the treaty, so we were under extreme poverty.
So this was a treaty made with the U.S. government and the Canadian government?
Yes, uh-huh.
And this treaty of 1873.
Yes, and they were duly in the know of the treaty. the crown, as they call it, the queen, actually copied treaties from the U.S. government. You know, they knew what the U.S. government did with Ojibwe tribes across the state line, so they were attempting the same type of assimilation into white culture for native people.
So by assimilation, they didn't want the Ojibwe out hunting and foraging anymore. Is that the general idea?
Yeah. Well, they didn't want us to be warriors anymore. They didn't want us to be hunter-gatherers. They didn't want us to live our traditional ways. They were afraid of us having powwows because they believed that we had some strange supernatural power from that, or that there was going to be some type of ridiculous uprising.
Well, that sounds like the ghost dance, doesn't it? Where the government did believe there was going to be an uprising and slaughtered them all.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was, and that was actually their belief. They appeared very paranoid about, you know, they didn't have an understanding of why we danced. You know, we didn't actually call them powwows either at that time. That's another English misnomer. But anyway, we had social dances and where we gave thanks, and it was like our church, our way of giving praise to the Creator and being grateful for what the Creator has provided for us.
So the dancing was your religious observance, is what you're saying?
Yes, uh-huh. That's all it was. It was honoring certain animals in the hunt and things like that. You know, if we had a good season with rice, if we had a good season with hunting deer or beaver and, you know, muskrat. Just giving thanks for our livelihood. That originally, when we were in poverty, we didn't necessarily believe we were in poverty because we had all of the wild animals that we hunted and trapped and fished, and but we didn't have the other luxuries of electricity and
running
water.
You were in poverty by American standards, but you didn't think of yourself as poor, is what you're saying. Is that
yes,
right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
So the Treaty of 1873, that was significantly before you were born, but it promised the tribe what? Food and various supplies?
There was like two animals per family, two horses, two cows, two pigs, you know, in that order, mainly because their way of assimilating us was to make us into farmers. And some of us did actually farm, and were successful at it. My family, we became commercial fishermen, and we made a heck of a good life with that by non-Indian standards.
Uh-huh.
My grandfather built his own home and raised 12 children very well through that. Had his own baseball team.
Really? You know? His own baseball team?
Yeah, but, championship.
But when you were born, you're saying that your people were really still in poverty by what we would call our normal American standards, and you were just pulling out of poverty. Could you explain that? What were the conditions like when you were coming up, which I'm assuming was what, the 1950s?
Early 60s, and I remember late 50s. I was born in 49, so in 59 I was like 10 years old. I remember back to about 55. I remember back about 1955. The time that I experienced extreme poverty was when we had, say, a hungry season. There were no berries or no foliage for the deer to eat. So there were less deer and there were less bear and there was less everything. And we didn't have any game to hunt, and the fishing wasn't any good. So we weren't getting supplies, like basic supplies, which were very bad food too. It was all white food, white rice, white flour, that kind of thing. You
know. So 55 was a lean year.
Yeah, yeah, and I remember that well. You know. So
did you go out hunting or anything like that during that time?
We did. You know, we tried hunting, but it was very lean hunting, and you know, maybe we got one deer or something like that. For the winter,
mm-hmm.
when usually we would get four or five, and we'd share it amongst extended family members and relatives. So that was kind of our way of living. Every fall we'd go hunting, and five or six men, and my dad would take me along and teach me the way of running deer, you know, maybe from a mile to a clearing or up a hill, and then the other hunters would wait for them to come out and get the deer.
You were hunting with a rifle or bows?
We were hunting with rifles. That was another provision that was given too. We were given a box of ammunition and either a 30-30 rifle or a 12-gauge shotgun. And
But when you say running deer, you had a tactic for chasing the deer down with a couple of guys?
Yeah, we would have three or four guys to run from the edge of the muskeg to a clearing up on the hill, and then my dad and the other hunters would wait up on the hill for the deer to come out in the clearing, and then that was more of a fair game way of getting deer and meat for the winter. You know, we used everything, you know, the hide, the bones, on, you know, from the deer. We never wasted anything, and we never took any more than we needed. You know, that's kind of the Indian way.
What did you guys do with the hide, Rod?
Well, we tanned the hide, and we made shirts, moccasins, different things, different carrying bags. And
how about the bones? Yeah. What'd you do with those?
They were used for utensils and sometimes knife handles and that sort of thing.
How about stomachs or any other parts? Did you use other parts of the animal?
Yeah, well, some of the intestines, actually, we used to cook, which were very, very tasty, very good. Some people wouldn't even think of doing
that. Sounds like chitlins.
Well, I don't know if that's what they are, but yeah. they were really good. We used to do the same thing with fish, fish guts. We used to fry them, and they were really good, too. I really liked them as a kid. And
so you were 10 years old when you were learning how to hunt deer.
Yeah, at 10 and probably maybe a year before that, I was learning to hunt and fish and trap. So, I mean, I know about trapping beaver and muskrat. And muskrat, by the way, you know, kind of sounds bad, but it was very tasty, too. They ate foliage. They were vegetarian, so what better meat could you get, you know?
So you'd go out setting regular traps and then go check your trap lines, right?
Yeah, and there's a specific way to set your traps, and there's a specific strategy in working with the beaver dams in order to entice your beaver to your trap.
Did you have limits that you had to abide by?
We had traditional limits. You know, my father always was very strict about hunting, fishing, and trapping, and even with the deer, with the young deer, if anyone ever killed a young deer, he really came down on them hard, because they had to be in season and they had to be a certain age, and if they weren't that age and he found out about it, they answered to him. You know, he was a very outstanding person.
So it sounds like your father was the taskmaster. He was the vice president that made sure everybody went by the rules.
Well, he was an excellent hunter. He was pretty good at all of his craft, you know. So a lot of the times when they wanted to go out, and if there was danger, like we had a lot of bears one season, and they would come and get my dad, and go out and look, you know, for bears, so they could eliminate the, you know, the threat of the bears, because the hungry season they come really close to our house, you know. I remember one.
So you had bears that came around your home.
Yeah.
So describe your area. This is very rural, it sounds like, where you were living.
Yeah, it's very rural. We have like a private road off of the main highway. And our house is close to a field. It's kind of a hay field in the back of our house, and has a stream running through the back of it. And we used to have deer in the back of that field, too, and we could see them every morning, about six or eight deer running and jumping, and you know, and they'll go in the stream to drink water.
How close were the nearest neighbors?
Well, we had neighbors right across the road from us, actually, and we had a well where we used to get water from there, you know, really cool water.
No plumbing when you were growing up?
No, we had to get water from a well.
So you pump your well? You do the hand crank pump back in the old days?
Yeah, yes. And then when we lived by the lake, of course, I used to haul water for, you know, the elders then from the lake. And I used to have kind of a harness where I carried these 5-gallon pails and filled up water from the lake until the lake got polluted and they told us not to drink that water anymore.
You did that every day? Brought 2 5-gallon pails from the lake?
Yeah, I used to like being with the elders, and I used to like helping them and stuff. And you know, I don't know if it was because they gave me quarters or what, but they taught me other things too. They taught me about, you know, tanning hides and skinning deer, you know, dressing deer and beaver and muskrat and all that. And I've actually been there when they were building actual birch bark canoe, and they built birch bark smokehouses, and I built them with them. And I was very fortunate to be there and learn all that. But I still wonder why I pursued all that as a child, because I pursued them, and I always try to be there when there was an event happening. You know, so.
And a lot of these are like totally lost arts, aren't they? I mean, I don't know of anybody who builds birch bark canoes anymore. That's where you have to strip off the large sheets of the birch and treat it just so, and then I think you take some roots of spruce or something and sew it together.
And there's different ways and different procedures of doing that, you know, different things that you have to get from the trees in order to fully assemble one.
But you were like in your early teens when you were learning all this?
Yeah, I was between 10 and actually 13. You know, when I had learned most of it.
Do you think that there are Ojibwa people today still who are keeping these old arts alive?
Well, my brother is. I know that for sure, because excuse me, my brother was taught after I had left for the city.
He's still in Canada?
Yeah, my brother's still in Canada, and he's a good sportsman as well, if you want to call it that. He's a good survivalist. And
he can live off the land.
Yeah, he hunts and fishes and traps, and he actually guides people too that come from California here. That's another thing that my family does, is that people who more or less want a wilderness adventure, they get the real thing from my family, because we take them up and we know the places where to fish and we know the places where to hunt. And
oh, so you get hunters and people wanting a backpacking experience.
Yeah.
Your family does that?
Yeah, and we take them up. And
how do people reach them if somebody listening just wants to do that? You know, I'll tell you what, people can always get the information from me if they email me.
Yeah.
But do you know offhand what the contact information would be?
Well, besides contacting you, they could phone me, I guess, and then I can put them in contact with my brother.
Do you want to give your number on the radio?
Yeah, my number is 323-671-9992.
Okay.
Yeah, and I have some knowledge of traditional remedies also for different ailments, and I would share that information as well.
So, Rod, your family takes people out and they learn all the wilderness survival stuff. So what do you think about these different guys on TV going into the woods and doing these survival, you know, all these survival shows that they have now? What do you think about those shows? Is it what you learned growing up?
Some of it is, actually. And I think some of these people, they've lived a life as well, you know. Some of the people from the South and you know, they've lived that kind of life, so, you know, I think it's good, you know. I don't think they're copying Indian ways or anything like that. I mean, I think they've lived their life, and they're kind of showing that, you know.
So, interesting. Yeah. So you were saying then that you had no plumbing, but you were getting out of poverty when you were growing up because of what was the factor that helped the tribe, the Ojibwa people, get out of poverty?
Well, one of my uncles became chief, and he was more...
What was his name?
Ralph Bruyere.
Uh-huh.
And he was more educated, and he had gone to the parliament, the head of government, prime minister, and talked to him about honoring the treaties, and I don't know what he told them, but they honored every treaty, and along with corporations being formed in business, starting with the wild rice, we started coming out of poverty. We started building better homes and getting better jobs, and
because of wild rice.
Mainly because of wild rice. It seems mm-hmm. like a minor thing, but it was a major thing to pull us out of being hungry and cold. And you know, the winters are very cold up there. You can have a 40 below zero temperature, and it'll have a 90 degree wind chill factor because of the blizzards and the snow. But we learned to live with that, and I enjoyed growing up like that. You know?
So because of wild rice, you all suddenly had modern homes, right?
Not totally, but yeah. You know, it started, that's where it started, and...
Not totally, meaning there was electricity, right?
There was some electricity.
Some electricity.
But not a lot.
Not a lot, okay.
Yeah, some houses had electricity.
And you still hauled water from the lake.
I still hauled water from the lake.
So what the difference was, you still had an outhouse. Mm-hmm. So basically you had a house. You had you said you had a four-bedroom house.
Yeah.
But you still were pretty much living off the land, it sounds like. Hauling your water, you had an outhouse.
Yeah, and we were still hunting and stuff like that. But we developed more like social programs. We had monies to clear the land and paid people to do it and mm-hmm. paid people to build more houses. And
money can do a lot when the money starts flowing.
Yeah, and we bought more gill nets. Like we fished by gill net.
What does that mean?
And
could you explain that?
Well, actually, it's a net that's probably maybe 25 feet across and maybe about 15 feet deep that we would set in the lake when we know the fish are traveling by and we'd catch the fish in the net and
uh-huh.
next day we'd pull the net and have a lot of fish from it, which we would sell to the people in the town, and then actually we used to sell to Hams in Minnesota. It was a Hams Brewing Company. We used to buy all our fish. And
now you said you would sell the fish in town. Was that the town was off the reservation?
Yeah, the town was actually about 5 miles off the reservation.
What town was that?
It's called Fort Francis. There was an actual fort there, and when the first explorers came, the French explorers. And I don't know if the Francis was a queen or what, but probably was one of the monarchy, because the United Kingdom had sent explorers at that time
mm-hmm.
to discover us.
So in any event, then you started, at least you had, you said, a 4-bedroom home, but you're still for the most part hauling your water. How'd you cook? Did you have gas stoves at this point growing up?
Well, we had wood stoves for cooking.
Wood stoves.
Yeah, so we that's another thing we did was I had to know and learn which trees to cut and what was good for wood and what wood was longer burning for keeping the house warm at night and that sort of thing, you know. There was some type of, I remember, ash wood that we burned at nighttime because it was longer burning.
The ash tree.
Yeah, and it was a little greener, but we'd cut it and then stockpile it, and it would dry a little bit, but it would burn longer.
Mm-hmm.
And we had spruce and that sort of thing for daytime.
Another bus is going by, folks. We're just sitting down here in downtown Highland Park. Well, you know, there's a lot of folks today, and there's really a movement of people trying to be more self-reliant. And it's kind of ironic that people regarded that as being poor. And you had your wood stove, you had an outhouse, you pumped your water. You really were totally self-reliant, if you think about it.
Yeah.
And you were getting more modern. You had money flowing, so you could pay people to do things. But isn't that interesting that so many city dwellers they don't know how to do anything, and they try to go back to these ways? I mean, didn't you say that you guys would have, your family would have hunters from out of town going there, and they didn't realize, you know, remember somebody said, you know, you advertised Indian guides.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then you served them dinner. Tell me that interesting, that funny story once.
Yeah, well, my father and my uncles were working for a camp, and they advertise in California and all throughout the U.S. about wilderness vacations, and with Indian guides on the flyer and the posting in magazines. And several of these tourists from California and Chicago, they would all eat in a big kind of a banquet hall and eating traditional food.
What was traditional food?
Well, they had like wild rice and wild duck and
I see.
Beaver, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And the people actually were all native people that worked there, that did the cooking and did all the necessary things. They were having dinner, and one of the guys stood up and he said, well, he was disappointed that where were the Indian guides? And one of the people, I guess my father, got up and he said, well, you're sitting right next to them and I'm one of them.
So in other words, they were expecting traditional garb or something. They didn't even recognize that they were with Indians.
Yeah, I think they expected like feathers and all this stuff, you know.
Right. And that's kind of more Hollywood as far as that goes.
Yeah, and all that stuff that, you know, comes from old Hollywood is mostly not true anyway.
Right.
More stereotypical and the wrong stereotype.
Like dances with wolves.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's really not the truth. I think, though, Dances with Wolves came more to the truth than any of the old movies. The old movies, I think they were very racist and prejudiced, you know. Sometimes I watch them and I get angry, or sometimes I watch them and I laugh, you know, how stupid and ignorant.
Well, Indians were always the bad guys.
Yeah, and they always made us look stupid or something like that, and actually they were the stupid ones, and just a lot of conflicting stories that they put out there. And people believe those kind of things. I don't know how they can just believe in a movie, because a movie...
Hey, the cinema is powerful. People see it, they think it's got to be true.
Yeah. It's mostly fictitious entertainment, you know, is my belief. And I think every educated person should believe that, you know, that I'm going to this movie for entertainment. This is not fact, you know.
Mm-hmm. But you thought that Dances with Wolves came a little closer than some? Because I think it was historically wrong. In the wrong time zone, but...
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of their garb and their hairstyles and everything like that were wrong.
Uh-huh.
But the relations were kind of true in a way, you know?
In other words, it portrayed the actual people as they are, not as some phony bad guy or something.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, the people, all the native people that lived around the fort actually were friends of the fort, and they actually traded with the fort. And they were not the enemies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I mean by it was more of an accurate portrayal. You know, they weren't shooting flaming arrows at the fort and all weird
right.
stuff like that.
Did you happen to see the movie called Geronimo with Wes Studi?
I think I did, but I remember it vaguely.
I thought that was a pretty accurate portrayal of a unique period in Native American history. I've always strongly recommended that particular movie.
Mm.
I liked it for a lot of reasons.
Yeah. Well, Geronimo, I think he was a fierce warrior. He was a small man, probably about 5'4".
Mm-hmm. They also depicted him as a spiritual leader, which a lot of people didn't know.
Yeah, he was. He was a very strong spiritual leader. That's why people followed him. That's why people, you know, just wanted to be with him and defend what he wanted to defend, and that was our culture and our way of life. You know, it wasn't anything against, say, white people or the white government.
Mm-hmm.
He was just trying to help our people to survive, and,
mm-hmm.
and I think that was it. You know, and
now since we're talking about movies, Vine Deloria, he wrote God Is Red and Custer Died for Your Sins and a lot of other classic books. I once asked him about, we were talking about the influence of movies, and he said one of the great tragedies, in his opinion, was that there are so many Native American youth living in the cities who watched movies like Billy Jack. He specifically mentioned Billy Jack.
Yeah.
And they think they know what Indian culture is all about from watching the ceremonies in those movies, which are mostly phony.
Yeah.
And he, in fact, what he thought was that it was a good thing that people were interested in some of the traditional ways, but that in his experience, people didn't have nearly the patience to become tribal, to really understand what it was all about. Because you can't just watch a TV show. You can't just watch Dances with Wolves and get it. You know, you almost have to be in that society like you were growing up in your childhood and to this day, really.
Yeah. Well, in being tribal, you know, that's my kind of my cheap saying or my motto in life is to think tribal, live tribal, and love tribal, you know.
And tell us what that means to you.
Well, you know, thinking tribal is thinking of everybody, you know, thinking of everyone and for the greater good and survival, you know. And living tribal is actually being and doing tribal things together, you know, and helping one another, you know, for survival, actually, you know, and loving that, and is just being in that moment and being in that spiritual place all the time, you know, daily. When you wake up, you know, you give thanks to the Creator for another day, for another opportunity, you know, and for things that you may have accomplished in the day passing, you know, and even for things that you don't have, you know, you give thanks for that, because what you don't have, maybe what you don't need in your life, you know, and you can be grateful for that, you know, because sometimes people will pray for things and you can be praying for the wrong thing and you'll get the wrong thing.
So, or watch what you pray for, right?
Yeah.
But you were saying that growing up you had a ceremony, your people had a ceremony for everything. Give me some examples.
Well, we had ceremony meaning giving thanks, you know, before, like for the hunt, if we were hunting ducks and you know, we had a good hunt and a lot of people got food from that, you know. We had kind of a ceremony.
Describe for me what the ceremony would look like.
Well, it would be praying with sage.
Uh-huh.
Most of the time, for us, it was with cedar. We used the cedar trees as to carry our prayers up. We believe that using the smoke carries our prayers up to the Creator.
So you would burn it in a bowl or something as part of your ceremony?
Yeah, we burn it in a bowl and then, you know, give praise for that, you know. Sometimes we would have dancing, like native dancing, and just a brief thing like that.
Mm-hmm.
We have a fire, you know, sometimes where we're burning the sage. If we don't burn in a bowl, we burn it in that fire, the campfire.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do there is, I lost my train of thought.
Well, okay, so did you guys do sweats too?
We had sweat lodges, mainly for special occasions, you know.
So that would be more involved.
Yeah. By then it wasn't a daily thing, but I believe, you know, our ancestors probably did that daily or, you know, on a regular basis, you know. And we would have it done mainly on special occasions. Okay. Or if someone seemed to be, you know, afflicted by something and they requested that from the medicine man, then they would, you know, relatives would go with him in the sweat and you know, till he was done and got rid of all his,
uh-huh,
you know, bad spirits and impurities, you know. Today we would do sweats mainly to get rid of all impurities from food that we eat, you know, that's preserved by chemicals and that sort of thing. And we come out really feeling really new, really reborn.
So people up in Canada are still doing the sweats?
Yes, they are, yeah. There's a resurgence now of culture in Canada. We were stifled in the early 60s as well by the churches and the government.
You were stifled by the churches? Why would they care if you're doing a sweat or not?
Well, they said that we were pagan doing powwows and pagan doing sweats.
Now, the church exercised some control over the Ojibwa nation?
Yeah, the churches, along with the treaties, had, you know, extreme control over the tribes.
And this is the treaty of, this goes back to the Treaty of 1873?
Yeah. Yeah. They,
now, how did the churches, I may be ignorant on this point, but how did the churches get involved? They were like the go-between between the tribe and the U.S. government, or what?
Yeah, they were, actually, largely, as I found out, I have an actual copy of the actual treaty and read it, and they were contracted to build schools, residential schools, where they would more or less brainwash native kids into so-called civilized ways and annihilate, they were trying to annihilate the society of native belief and culture. So the government actually built the schools for the Catholic Church, for the Anglican Church, and there's some other churches too on that list that I I can't remember right now, but there were several different other religions that were doing the same thing.
So the U.S. government basically contracted with the churches to kind of run things and whip the Ojibwa into shape.
Yeah, the U.S. government and also the crown, the Queen of England.
Oh, that's right, because you're in Canada.
Yeah.
And did the native religion have to go underground during these years?
During those years, they got certain families that were prevalent in their churches, and those people more or less got rid of our, like, we had powwow pavilions that we built in a circle, and they destroyed those. And
who destroyed those?
The church and these people who were Indian Catholics and Indian Anglicans, and they had a great belief in the church, so they became in power with the chief and council, and somehow they manipulated themselves into chief and council where they could eliminate our culture. And only in the late 80s that we have, well, one thing that happened was another one of my uncles became chief. And he had tried to renegotiate the leases that we had on the lands with the non-Indian people. And
so there were non-Indians living on Ojibwa land in Canada.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And the leases on them were ridiculous. They had prime beachfront property with a golf course on it and a country club. And they leased that land for 100 years for $50 and two bottles of whiskey.
Who were they leasing it from? The Ojibwa tribe?
They were leasing it from my tribe at that time. Yeah. That was prior to the treaty.
I see.
So anyway, what my uncle did was he renegotiated the leases.
When the 100 years came up.
Yeah. At, you know, at today's value. And they didn't like it, so they moved off. He told them, well, you know, you either pay the lease at today's rates or you move. And
so that's how the Ojibwe got a lot of their land back.
They moved, yeah, and we got a lot of that back. But recently, today, we have a park where a lot of the townspeople, the non-Indian people, go there too and celebrate. We celebrated a lot of our treaties over there. And well, when I get to the treaty, you're gonna find this very ridiculous. But we celebrated our treaties there by having traditional games and things like that, and sort of cooking out together, cooking traditional foods, and just enjoying like the all-American barbecue, I guess. So I guess we invented the barbecue, you know, because we were doing that a long time ago, celebrating that way, and.
Well,
now there's a conflict about that point of land where the explorers landed. They had a lease on it, a verbal agreement, and they're trying to say that that belongs to them.
Who is them?
The non-Indian people from the town.
I see.
And, like, we actually were, you know, friendly with those people in those times, because during our times of our hunger and poverty, some of the grocers in that town actually supported us, you know, during that time. And but now those people passed on, you know. It's a funny thing because, in the 80s, we were going to open a Walmart, and we didn't because of the townspeople that had supported us during that time. They were still living, so we didn't want to open a business and then, you know, stifle their income and their livelihood. So
isn't that interesting how thoughtful you could still be after so like a century or more of people pretty much stepping on you? I mean, you still have a sense of grace and thoughtfulness of the other guy. I mean, it really is a good example, a good shining example of how everybody ought to be, if you think about it.
Well, that's the Indian way, you know. Like, there's a lot of things that have been done, and we still honor this country, both Canada and the U.S. Like, anytime there's a conflict and, you know, people need to go to war, a lot of natives born in Canada will come and enlist in the Marines in the U.S. and go to war. I mean, from Korea, Vietnam, to Afghanistan, to the Gulf War, you know.
Right, because there's the long warrior tradition. They're not draft dodgers in the native culture.
Yeah, I think that's in our blood. I mean, we're warriors, and a lot of people have been, you know, back in the 70s, Green Berets and Navy SEALs, you know, they've been specialists in war, and they've done their fair share. You know, I mean, we still honor this country because we're from the land. You know, we believe that we're from the land, and that's why we'll fight for this country alongside other people that maybe dishonored us. But you know, that doesn't matter to us. What matters is we all live here, and when they first came, we believed that this land was put here for everybody, and that's why it was so easy to, you know, steal the land, because of our belief, you know, and we still believe that. We still believe that this land is put here for everybody to...
Still taking the higher road, which is really good.
Yeah.
Hey, Rod, so everything has been relating to this 1873 treaty. Can you talk a little on that then? Tell us more about the treaty and the ramifications to this day.
Yeah, well, the treaty mainly was set up to...
Another bus going by in beautiful downtown Highland Park. Okay, the treaty was set up, what'd you say?
Yeah, the treaty was set up mainly as a form of cultural genocide.
That's quite a statement.
And it was, you know, put in a nice way. Their verbiage on that was that, you know, they were attempting to civilize us, you know. You know, the way I think now, I don't know who was civilized or who had the authority to say who was or who wasn't, you know. We were living a very civilized life, and we always try to live by civilized means now, you know.
I've always heard that the victors in a war write the history, whether it's right or wrong. They contort the facts the way they want them to be.
Oh, it's true, you know. I mean, a lot of history, a lot of American history, you know, I really hate to say it, but it's not true, you know. I mean, a lot of the history, they don't tell the truth about what actually happened, you know, or about their heroes even, you know.
Or why it happened, or what they leave out is equally as important as what they tell you.
Yeah, or they leave out the bad parts about that person, you know. They just tell, oh, this one great event that this person did, and then meanwhile, in the background, well, the person really wasn't for those people that he freed, or you know, it's free the people, but they're not equal, you know, and that sort of thing. So I think that was kind of a bad thing in a way. I mean, if you free people, they should be equal. Yeah.
So you've actually gotten a copy of this 1873 treaty and read through it and saw what some of the stipulations were, right?
Yeah, and it's very long and drawn out. I don't know how many pages. It's probably over 100 pages of things and ways and means of brainwashing the native nations and assimilating. Largely they thought it was a right and just thing to assimilate native culture into white culture. You know, they thought that was a good thing that they were doing, I guess.
Well, that was done all over North America.
Yeah, it was done all over North America, Canada.
Australia, too.
Yeah, Australia is another one, and I believe even in the Middle East with the... Well, the Palestinian people, I think they kind of took their land, the Israelis, and they won't give it back, and that's supposed to be the reason for the war over there now, you know. But I look at different indigenous people in the world, and that's what's happening to them, what happened to us. You know?
Still happening, you're saying?
Yeah, it's still happening today in the Amazon and even in Guatemala today. You know, there's Canadian companies going in there and mining and taking the land from the indigenous people there, you know. It's just a vicious cycle that goes on and on, you know. In taking land from people that are of the land, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So really, that's the sad part about all this. We think we get a little enlightened, and yet there's always land grabs, and the almighty dollar is what we're worshiping, and taking rights away from other people. Now, Rod, if people want to learn more about the Ojibwe Nation and some of the historical things you're discussing, are there internet or are there books that they could look into that would be ideally suited for this?
Yeah, I have a page actually on Facebook, and it's called Tribal Americans 3000.
It's called, say that again?
Tribal Americans 3000.
Tribal Americans 3000, and they'd look under your name under Facebook or just Tribal Americans 3000?
Well, they can look under both. Uh-huh. They can look under Rod William Bruyere.
Bruyere.
Yes, and Tribal Americans 3000 is my other page that I have.
What kind of things would people see there?
I have mostly traditional cultural things, stories, remedial herbal things.
Okay, wow. People could get information on uses of herbs, traditional uses of herbs, too.
Yes, yes, and traditional ways, different stories that I will personally post.
Do you get people asking you questions when they go to that site?
I have a lot of people that really appreciate a lot of the posts that I have. Sometimes people do ask questions, but largely not.
Uh-huh.
I think mainly because they don't want to appear ignorant, you know, and I don't think, if they're asking the question in the right sense, I don't think that there's any bad question when you really want to know about something.
If I was afraid of appearing ignorant, I would have never learned anything all my life.
Yeah.
You know, that reminds me of an interesting quote that somebody once said. It is, how does the quote go? It is better to remain quiet and be considered a fool than to open my mouth and erase all doubt.
Yeah. No bad question.
No, I mean, if you don't know, you don't know. Everybody knows what they know, and you're always trying to learn something new. But we're out of time today, Rod, and I really appreciate you taking your morning, and I hope we can do this again and touch on other aspects of the Ojibwe culture.
Okay, I appreciate it, too. Yeah, and I look forward to talking with you again and maybe giving some more correct information, because there are a lot of stereotypical information out there that's just not right, and I'd like to kind of take care of that, you know. I mean, we don't get free money, and, you know, we don't have free gas and that kind of thing. It's ridiculous. That's what I mean by ignorant questions, like, you know, can I touch your hair and that kind of thing.
You know, where are your beads, right?
You know, yeah.
Thank you, Rod. Until next time.
All right, and thanks very much to all.